Spirit Blade Underground, episode 455. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for system file. Spirit Blade Underground, episode 455.
Hello and welcome to the monitor room again. I'm having my own personal little Groundhog Day here because I just finished recording and editing last week's podcast. As I record this week's episode and last week's, it is April 10th. It is about a week and a half before our big move. And so anyway, I'm doing all this in advance so that I can be freed up to do all the moving stuff that I have to do. But nevertheless, regardless of what time, space, dimension you are in, I am sitting here in the monitor room at the Spirit Blade Underground Podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment, as well as the official podcast of Christian Geek Central, a website and community you can check out at ChristianGeekCentral.com. I'm Peter Franson from Spirit Blade Productions, producing entertainment and... oh, you can do it, Peter! Producing entertainment and resources to hopefully equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you and me to live more and more for Christ, no matter our crazy circumstances, right? For more info and free goodies, check out spiritblade.com. On the show today, we're jumping back to my bookshelf. It's been a while since we visited my bookshelf, but I'm going to be continuing my bookshelf tour. And this time, we're going to look at some PS2 RPGs that I have really enjoyed enough to hang on to after all these years. And then also, I'll talk a little bit about my experience so far with the Assassin's Creed series of games, which I just started getting into in the last few months. Then also, we've got a review of the Star Wars audiobook Darth Plagueis coming at you from the Netherlands. And we jump back into the long box to look at Doctor Who comics. Plus, we are back in the book of Ephesians with some thoughts on what all Christian geeks have in common and why our common ground is so important to remember. All right, lots to do. Let's get to it.
Hey all, this is Katja from the Netherlands, Comic Kate on the Christian Geek Central forums. I've taken up a new habit of geeky content consumption, namely audiobooks. Audiobooks are the ideal way to combine reading a novel while doing other stuff, and ever since I discovered the sheer endless well of narrated titles, I dove in and started swimming. So I thought I'd share my audiobook reviews with you. My intent is to keep them concise and mostly just about my experiences with the books, without doing a full-blown review. This will keep it easy to get a feel for what a book might bring you without having to spend too much time listening to me yapping on and on about it. I will start each review with the publisher's summary so you get a feel for the story. My first audiobook short is about a Star Wars novel from the so-called Expanded Universe, Darth Plagueis, written by James Luceno and narrated by Daniel Davis. The publisher's summary says: "He was the most powerful Sith Lord who ever lived, but could he be the only one who never died? Did you ever hear the tragedy of Darth Plagueis the Wise? It's a Sith legend. Darth Plagueis was a Dark Lord of the Sith, so powerful and so wise that he could use the Force to influence the midichlorians to create life. He had such a knowledge of the dark side that he could even keep the ones he cared about from dying." Quoted from Supreme Chancellor Palpatine, Star Wars Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith. Darth Plagueis, one of the most brilliant Sith Lords who ever lived. Possessing power is all he desires. Losing it is the only thing he fears. As an apprentice, he embraces the ruthless ways of the Sith. And when the time is right, he destroys his master. but vows never to suffer the same fate. For like no other disciple of the dark side, Darth Plagueis learns to command the ultimate power over life and death. Darth Sidious, Plagueis' chosen apprentice. Under the guidance of his master, he secretly studies the ways of the Sith, while publicly rising to power in the galactic government, first as senator, then as chancellor, and eventually as emperor. Darth Plagueis and Darth Sidious, master and acolyte, target the galaxy for domination, and the Jedi Order for annihilation. But can they defy the merciless Sith tradition? Or will the desire of one to rule supreme and the dream of the other to live forever sow the seeds of their destruction? As for my thoughts on this novel, I thought it was a captivating story. Brilliant reading performance by Daniel Davis, awesome audio effects and Star Wars music. This is precisely why I love audiobooks so much. The story clarifies a lot of Darth Sidious's background and, of course, tells the story of Darth Plagueis, the main character. To me, this audiobook captured a real Star Wars atmosphere. It made me want to listen to it 24/7, and I wish the novel had lasted at least twice as long. Because of it, I wanted to watch Star Wars Episode 1 immediately following it, which to some would be a great feat in and of itself. In short, I highly recommend this, and I would give it 5 stars for performance, 5 stars for the story, and so 5 stars overall. So thank you for listening. I will see you next time with my next audiobook short, and tot de volgende keer. Doei!
Ah, it's finally here. It took years and cost me a fortune to track down this collection of the rarest sequential art collections in the world.
They're just comics, Dad. You got them from the very back of the clearance bin at the comic shop.
Just help me get the lid off.
I am the genie of the long box. I shall grant you 3 wishes.
I wish I could read comics in a modern form that lets me take as many as I wanted anywhere I want.
It is done. Henceforth, comics shall descend from the cloud directly into your mobile device.
I wish publishers would give away free books to promote the growth of the art form.
It is done. Henceforth, the first Saturday in May shall be known as Free Comic Book Day.
I wish someone who really loved comics would do a podcast and article series about them.
Very well. Then I shall take you into the long box.
I'm afraid my association with Doctor Who is not as extensive or as storied as it could be. I watched Tom Baker and Elizabeth Sladen on PBS with the rest of my generation, but I was always more interested in Star Wars and Star Trek, Buck Rogers and Battlestar Galactica. Still, Tom Baker is who I think of as the Doctor, and the Fourth Doctor is my Doctor. I have friends who are massive Doctor Who fans, and I distinctly remember when Paul McGann's Doctor, when his movie first premiered, that we all threw a party for the advent of the Eighth Doctor. One day, my daughter excitedly grabbed my arm and said,
"Dad, you've got to see this show!"
She turned on BBC America, and there was David Tennant and Billy Piper saving the world. She explained patiently,
"This is a rerun. He's the Doctor, but he regenerates into new actors. Peter Capaldi will be the next Doctor soon."
I smiled, secure in the knowledge that I had done at least one thing right in her upbringing. Fueled by my daughter's excitement, the current generation of Doctor Who stories became scheduled family time and required viewing. When I decided it was once again time to venture into the world of comics, it was my wife who thrust the first issue of Supremacy of the Cybermen into my arms, saying,
"Here, I want to read this one."
"Be still, my fluttering heart." Titan Comics held the current license to the Doctor Who properties, and they were taking full advantage of it. They premiered ongoing titles for Doctors 9, 10, 11, and 12. They put out special multi-Doctor crossover events. They delivered limited series with the classic Doctors. It was all a bit overwhelming. I picked a few titles to follow and stuck with the 10th Doctor, the classic Doctors, and the crossover events. They've all been pretty good. Doctor Who stories are sci-fi adventure and mystery stories. They have a certain pacing and sense of discovery to them that provides the Doctor Who feel. For the Doctor, it's not about big dramatic set pieces or explosive action sequences. It's always been about choices and the morality of making choices. The Doctor himself is far from perfect, and though he's admittedly making things up as he goes along, he does look good doing it. Most other modern sci-fi stories focus on pushing the bounds of the possible against the inconceivable. The Doctor strives to take on the inconceivable and place it solidly within our current frame of reference. Thus, dramatic tension derives from what the protagonist ought to do, rather than what he is able to do. So the real question regarding the comics is, does it feel like Doctor Who? Like the television show, a variety of creators contribute to the final story. In this case, every Doctor's book has a different creative team. It falls to editor Andrew James to ensure the different titles maintain consistency with each other as well as the source material. I think he did a pretty good job. The Tenth Doctor routinely wanders into the middle of a mystery, trying to decipher the reasons behind a dangerous situation before it spirals out of control. He's a bit of a loner who still manages to find someone with whom he can connect. He dives headfirst into danger, fully conscious that he's the only one who can adequately deal with the situation. His solutions are direct, his responses compassionate. Adventure and discovery are still out there. This Doctor struggles to look at the world with new eyes. Set between the departure of Donna Noble and the Tenth Doctor's final conflict with the Master, he takes on new companions for his adventures, capable individuals who want to discover the universe. This Doctor is a fighter and a protector, who knows better than to retreat into isolation. The 11th Doctor is more of a mentor than ever before. He also has new companions, people who are lost and need guidance. The Doctor is whimsical and subtle, coming at things from the side and turning every adventure into a teachable moment. The 12th Doctor travels alone. He is irascible and grumpy, taking on adventures because they are thrust upon him. This Doctor seems to be at the end of his patience with meddlers of all kinds, whether their intentions are good or ill. Both the 11th and 12th Doctors have ongoing titles, but I've only read their multi-doctor and anthology adventures. The 3rd and 4th Doctors received limited series, each one featuring a prominent companion. The 3rd Doctor remains a man of action who charges into situations alongside his companions. The 4th Doctor is still all flashing teeth and flying scarf, secure in the knowledge that everything is going to work out as it should. Their stories carry the unmistakable aura of the late 60s and early 70s, complete with period-accurate dialogue and the pseudo-surrealism that dominated the art and visual effects of the time. I found both stories to be eerily reminiscent of the show, as if they could have been adapted from the aired episodes. I thought they captured the spirit and flavor of Doctor Who very well. The stories are grounded in optimism and the confidence that we can be better people and make the world a better place if we only so choose to do and be. It's one of the things that keeps me coming back to the Doctor as a compelling hero. Of course, the Doctor is also predominantly, even defiantly, humanistic and materialistic. So many of the stories deal with creatures on other planes of reality or with other modes of existence that it's easy to forget the underlying ethos that all of these things are part of the natural order of the world, that those things we describe as spiritual are simply things we do not yet understand. It's a rational and compelling sola natura argument, made extremely attractive by the character of the Doctor and the show's emphasis on compassion and the preservation of life. Curiously, the Doctor himself provides the best rebuttal of his own argument. He firmly believes in the existence of morality and is able to frame his moral code in absolute terms. Some things are always good, and some are always evil. While codes of acceptable behavior vary from culture to culture, the definitions of good and evil do not change. The Doctor expects everyone with whom he deals to understand these values innately, not within their cultural frame of reference, but as a function of being a thinking, living individual. By contrast, the villains of Doctor Who are largely mechanical or pseudo-living, the tools of another power. Their capacity for individualism either never existed or has been forcibly taken from them. Villainy in the series is always destructive to others and is always by choice. So how is it that the Doctor expects every living being across the galaxy, in every time and dimension, to share a common definition of good and evil? Where does this come from? Doctor Who's sola natura premise defines as fallacious any logical construction that includes absolute morality. The question never arises within the series, leaving the viewer or reader to seek out the answers for themselves. this is a good thing if you are inclined to explore the concepts of the show. If you are willing to simply take things at face value, the underlying philosophy of the series provides all necessary truth pro forma, leaving no need to explore scripture and offering no validity to any religion's claims to absolute truth. I've enjoyed Titan Comics' Doctor Who stories a great deal, but I don't have any of them in my pull-and-hold file anymore, and the fault lies with Titan's publishing philosophy. Many of the books are printed with multiple covers, each following a different theme and making it very difficult to collect a story where all the covers match. Their printing schedule has been subject to unexpected delays, sometimes resulting in books more than 2 months apart in the same story arc. I don't mind waiting to read complete stories, and Titan consistently collects their titles into high-quality hardcovers and trade paperbacks. Instead of buying 12 books on a title every year, I only need to buy two, and I can find them at the Barnes & Noble around the corner. If you like Doctor Who, the Titan books are a great place to find your favorite Doctor. If you like good sci-fi adventure, the comic book versions of the Doctor will scratch that itch for you. If you're curious about the Doctor, but intimidated by the sheer quantity of the character's history, the comics provide a convenient starting place that is expressly intended to make new readers comfortable. I give Titan's Doctor Who books a quality score of excellent and a relevant score of subtle but high. And remember, you can check out the written version of this segment on the Christian Geek Central blog, complete with examples of artwork from the series.
Every now and then people ask me what's on my mind, so I thought I'd take a minute to answer that question. Now, pay attention, please, because I don't think I can do this more than once. All right, this part is my parietal lobe, and if I dig back in here, I can pull out some of my occipital. And I don't know what this part is, but whenever I touch it, I smell peanut butter. Back once again after a long break to my bookshelf tour. Now, we're actually getting ready to move, and so this might be the last time you see my bookshelf behind me, because the bookshelf itself is going to stay behind for the people that are buying our house. All of the stuff on it, of course, I'm taking with me, and I may or may not buy a new bookshelf. I'm not sure exactly what I'm going to do there, but I took video of all the contents of my bookshelf so that even as we move into my new office space and kind of get things set up there, I can still go through all the contents of my bookshelf, even as where those things are, you know, change. So once again, I've got a new timer this time. I'm going to set this for 10 minutes and see how far I can get in talking about the stuff on my bookshelf from where I left off last time. Ready, set, go. Okay, so first up is Final Fantasy XII. I've already said a good amount of this in a video that I made about Final Fantasy XII, just kind of introducing people to it, to the game, in light of the remaster, almost a remake. I mean, it's just a beautiful looking remaster, Final Fantasy XII, The Zodiac Age, which is coming to PlayStation 4 this early July 2017. I'm definitely planning on getting it. So I'll just try to put a link in the description so you can check out the video that I made about that game and really why I enjoy it so much for its Gambit system, the real time with pause, the AI adjustments you can make to characters, the exploring, looting, the epic spell and summon animation. So much I love about that. Moving on, Justice League Heroes. Now, this one I repurchased on PlayStation 2. I had bought it and got rid of it a long time ago and then repurchased it on Xbox, the original Xbox. This is a Snowblind action RPG. These guys made Baldur's Gate Dark Alliance, and I think they also had a hand, or some of the same people had a hand, in the Champions of Norrath series. So it's that top-down Diablo clone, but this with DC superheroes. And it was made at a time that was like reflecting my favorite things going on in the world of DC Comics. It was just a good time in the publishing history of DC Comics for my tastes, and so much that I love about it. About the same time the Marvel Ultimate Alliance came out, I actually prefer this game over Marvel Ultimate Alliance, and I think I can honestly say it's not just because I do prefer DC characters over Marvel characters, because at the end of the day, it's just whoever happens to be writing the best story at the time is where I'm going to gravitate toward. But all things being equal, I do like DC characters and their concepts more than Marvel. But no, this is really, I prefer it. I've played through this game multiple times, and it has to do with, I think, the gameplay systems, the leveling system, how you upgrade your guys. Just the style of a Snowblind top-down action RPG is really my thing. And to get that in this DC superhero package has been fantastic. I'm actually currently really replaying through it again because I've never beat it on the hardest difficulty, because the only way I can really do that is to really carry my guys through all the easier difficulties and in the long term, like strategically build them in a certain way so they'll be ready for that final playthrough. I mean, it's... There's a lot going on and a lot to unlock, lots of Easter eggs, all kinds of cool stuff. The Matrix Path of Neo. I prefer this one over the Enter the Matrix video game, which came out with the release of The Matrix Reloaded, because you get to be Neo. Now, the controls, if I go back to this game now, and I have in a recent stream not too long ago, the controls are kind of clunky. There's one or more escort missions, which I really hate, you know, and timed type missions. It's just stuff that I hate. But there's so many levels in here that don't have those things and just allow me to revel in the fantasy of being Neo at the height of his power. And especially if you use the built-in codes that are available for the game, you can enjoy whatever level you want and just play all the awesome fun parts of the game. Lots of fun. That's why it stays in my collection. It's not one that I'm always itching to play, you know, all the time, but I can't bring myself to get rid of it, because when I go back to it, I do enjoy myself. The Shadow Hearts trilogy. I think I've made a video about at least the first game in the series and just kind of talking about my love of the series as a whole. This is probably my favorite JRPG of all time. The first one, I should say, Shadow Hearts. Shadow Hearts Covenant started to get a little bit goofy, but still had some great gameplay. It's very H.P. Lovecraft inspired. It has a sanity system where the longer your guys are in combat, they start to kind of lose their minds and eventually they'll just go berserk. And that makes a lot more sense in the first game, which is really dark. And, you know, your characters are running into weird, mind-shattering, you know, creatures that are just so disturbing to look at. The creature designs in this are so wonderfully jacked up. I really enjoy that. But the series started to get more and more silly with each game, which made the sanity system seem... ironic, or I don't know, maybe the player should have a sanity meter or something, because it just really gets goofy in a Japanese anime kind of way with the third game. So the third game I have really mixed feelings about, and that's actually why I'm creating a playthrough series that I'm going to edit down and create just highlight videos of that I'm working through right now. And when I'm done recording it all, then I'll be editing it down and releasing that. I have no idea when. That could be a year from now before that's released. But anyway, that's something that's kind of in the works right now. I love the Judgment Ring system where, you know, it's turn-based, but every time you execute a move to see if you're successful or not, you have to hit the button at a certain time as this dial spins around on a ring, and you can kind of push your luck and try to hit it right at this, at the red spot near the end of the viable place where you can, you know, hit it to make your move activate. But if you let the dial go too far, your attack, you know, will miss or lose its effectiveness. So there's just something really cool about, you know, the cycle of fighting bad guys and keeping me engaged in combat, you know, but it's not really super difficult, you know, in terms of the hand-eye coordination stuff, and there's, you know, just all the usual great upgrade cycles and stuff, so I really enjoy that. It also exemplifies, especially in, I want to say, the second game, I think the first game as well, the natural bent of humanity to just kind of want to rebel against God, because the final boss in at least one of the first two games, maybe both of the first two games, is God, that you're fighting what they're calling God, you know, and it's just a really interesting, you know, thing to think about as, you know, as I'm playing through the game, like, well, this is really interesting, you know, and it is just kind of a snapshot of where we naturally lean toward, you know, that ultimately we naturally just kind of get offended that God should, you know, want to have, you know, any kind of authority over the things that he creates, you know, and so we just naturally want to rebel against all authority, and I think especially God. So it's an interesting little snapshot of just the human condition. Let's see, and then Justice League Heroes on the Xbox, I bought that. You could get greater graphical fidelity playing it on the original Xbox compared to the PS2, but there were just some buggy issues that made the frame rate kind of like stutter and freeze and in some annoying ways, and so I just kind of lost interest, and that's why I went back and repurchased the game on PlayStation 2. Let's see, Shin Megami Tensei. Nocturne specifically. This is part of the Shin Megami Tensei series. In my handheld game video, I talked about the DS game in the series that I was playing. This one's very similar. It's post-apocalyptic. It's kind of like a dark Pokemon game where you are fighting monsters, but then also recruiting them and then mixing them together to create new monsters, you know. And so instead of like looting and upgrading your weapons a lot, you're kind of upgrading your monster allies a lot, you know. The art design in this game is kind of minimalistic, similar into the Persona games, how it's almost a cel-shaded kind of minimalistic, low-texture kind of look to it. That's not really my style of visuals, but I really like the turn-based gameplay. It doesn't have any hand-eye coordination elements like Shadow Hearts, but it's fast, because as soon as you hit the button, boom, boom, your guys execute their moves. There's not a lot. The animations are cool, but they're not drawn out and spectacular, you know? And sometimes that's just what I'm in the mood for. And it also has an auto battle system where if, like, you fought these guys before, you don't need to think about the strategy. You just hit auto battle and your guys go, ka-ba, 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 and then the battle's, you know, over, you know? Unless they're too strong for you, and then you instantly die. So you only want to use that when you're confident you can beat the guys in front of you. So yeah, it really does a good job of keeping the pace moving, even though it's a turn-based RPG. There's some interesting moral and philosophical questions that you run into as you're interacting with and trying to recruit monsters. They'll ask you questions that are related to good and evil and the moral implications of survival of the fittest. So there's some interesting things to think about as you play Shin Megami Tensei Nocturne. All right, Dragon Quest VI. I don't know what that box is doing there. It's in the wrong place. I already talked about that in my handheld game section. Assassin's Creed. I actually have the second one as well. And that it just wasn't on the shelf at the time. I don't know, must have misplaced it when I was recording that. But I tried this series for the first time after watching the movie, because it's not that the movie blew me away, but I was like, you know, this is pretty solid. I've got some issues with it, but, you know, there's a lot of things that I think are really solid about this movie. It got me interested and curious about the world, and so I tried out the first game. I'm really enjoying these games. I beat the first game, which is reportedly the hardest game in the series, which makes me feel like, okay, I, who suck at action games, can get through the first game. There's a good shot I'll be able to get through this entire series. And if I enjoy the gameplay, I'm definitely going to do that. And so far, I am. You know, I like the open world climbing and the stealth kills. And there are some lame story missions that you're forced to do to progress the game that are like either escort-based or they're time-based and they kind of have insta-fail conditions, you know. But I do plan to continue. The premise in this game, in many cases, or the premises, there are multiple, are often based on, I don't want to say often, but in a significant number are based on a false understanding of even very basic biblical content. And if you watch my review of the Assassin's Creed movie, that's an example of the kinds of things that this series seems to just be getting wrong. It's just like, where did you learn about the Bible? I mean, did you even open the Bible? You're talking about these things that happened in it, anyway, that didn't happen. All right, so you know, it falls pretty short in that regard. Even though they have a message at the beginning that said this game was made by a collection of people on staff of multiple, you know, cultural and religious backgrounds and stuff like that, it was like, okay, well, they can be from all these different backgrounds and still get all this stuff, you know, not all this stuff, but still get some key issues horribly wrong. So I hope that's not being put there as like a, hey, don't get mad at us because we're being really inclusive. Okay, well, you can be inclusive and get things wrong. So, good job being inclusive. You know, we want to be tolerant and inclusive and open to ideas, but I think we also want to seek truth. Even when we're doing fiction, you know, if we want our fiction to be engaging, then I think that there's got to be a baseline of things that are accurate and based on, you know, real, based on reality, so that can help us suspend disbelief and take that next step into fantasy with you. But if you don't have that groundwork of, you know, your facts straight, then it's hard to suspend disbelief and join you in your fantasy. So that is where I ran out of time on this one. Next time, I will pick it up talking about the Bioshock trilogy, which, holy crap, opened up an entirely new world of video games to me. I'll talk about that next time. I want to remind you guys to check out the other members of the Christian Geek Central Network, such as the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, the Untold podcast, POS, TOS, and Helix Reviews. I did it. For more information about the CGC Network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com.
Data collection complete. Activating MusicNet 1.0.
This week at youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral, I've put up part 4 of my 2016 Extra Life series, in which I've cut down kind of highlights and key moments that from that stream, including this week the story of my first kiss and why my wife rocks. And then also the bookshelf tour is going to be up as well this week, and Gosh, let's see here. Yeah, you know what? I was just thinking to myself, Pater, do you want to actually take the audio from that first kiss and the wife thing and put that as part of the... But no, we've got enough content. You know, we're good to go. All right. Gotta get all my ducks in a row before all this moving craziness. But anyway, yeah, the bookshelf tour, the video version of that. So if you want to see, like, covers... video game cases and, you know, artwork and stuff, and also a little bit of video footage from at least one or two of the games that that I mentioned. So that video should be up as well at youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral. And while you're there, if you want to like, share, and subscribe, that does help to grow our community first at YouTube. And then my hope is that the folks that interact with us at YouTube will find their way to ChristianGeekCentral.com and the forums and connect with more of us there. At youtube.com/spiritbladevideos this week. And if I've done my job right, man, a lot of my job that I have to do right. See, I'm talking about all this. Whenever I say if I've done my job right, you know, then this will be there. It's, you know, it's because I haven't done that yet. And I'm recording before that's actually been done. So, and here I'm talking about stuff that like, is a week and a half out, and I'm like, man, I better be sure that I get my ducks in a row before I check out to do all the moving stuff. I'm going to try and, like, upload all this stuff in advance and actually, like, time it so that it will auto-release or auto-post or something like that. I don't even know if I'm going to be checking email during this time. I don't think I'm officially going to go off-grid, but, like, you know, there's going to be about 3 days where I don't have internet access. So, anyway... If I do my job right, then this will be up at Spirit Blade Videos and at spiritblade.com. But anyway, part seven of my commentary of Spirit Blade, A World of Shadows is what should be up by now, in which I talk about the complex detail work that went into Rand Galvanic's epic window-leaping, butt-kicking action sequence from Spirit Blade, A World of Shadows. And that scene also has Merrick Scythe's most spectacular use, if you can use the word spectacular in an audio drama, the most spectacular use of his power that I think is in the entire trilogy, arguably. So that was like just a massive, crazy action scene. Lots of stuff going on and lots of detail work that went into it. So I talk about all those things that you maybe didn't notice in part seven of my Spirit Blade, A World of Shadows commentary. Again, at youtube.com/spiritbladevideos. All right, I think that's about it. Just as a reminder, if you want to help make sure Spirit Blade Productions can keep doing what we're doing or do more of it, both faster and better, then you're invited to make a donation of any amount, anytime, or become a part of the Spirit Blade Insider Program and get monthly exclusive goodies. For more info, you can visit our About page at spiritblade.com. And of course, while you're there, you're also invited to support us by purchasing a download of one of our original sci-fi or fantasy audio dramas for a friend or family member with our available gift codes. Again, for info, visit spiritblade.com.
The truth will set you free.
Truth is that which corresponds to fact or reality. To assert that truth is not absolute is a self-defeating proposition. Now, lots of things are possible, but our beliefs should reflect the best explanation of the available evidence. I'm no expert, but the information is out there. You'd be amazed what you can learn if you spend some time in search of truth.
The truth.
Well, in this segment, I attempt to examine the Bible and dissect some of the churchy language that we can easily take for granted, digging into history and languages as I'm able to try and get at the heart of the text so we can hopefully see and then apply some of what God has for us in these words today. Now, I'm not formally trained in Scripture. I'm just a guy using resources and a questioning mind to try and get at the truth. And I hope that you'll do that with me. I think that's something we can all do much more so than any generation that's come before us in all of human history. There is so much at our disposal that we can take advantage of in our efforts to seek out the truth of what is being said to us timelessly through Scripture. This time we're looking at Ephesians chapter 4, verses 4 through 6. We've been going through the book of Ephesians. We took a break from it last week, but now we're back into it. And Ephesians 4, 4 through 6 in the ESV reads, "There is one body and one spirit, just as you were called to the one hope that belongs to your call. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all. All right, so looking at verse 4 to start with, believers in Jesus, regardless of tradition, doctrinal differences, or culture, are all part of one body of believers. This is what Scripture means when it refers to the church. It's the body of believers everywhere, and adds the Scripture adds the names of like cities, regions, etc. You know, the church in blank, to become more locally or organizationally specific. But it's that it's the body of all believers that's referred to as that is referring to the church. Excuse me. Believers are also unified by the fact that they all have the Holy Spirit as an identifying seal, as it were, of their standing with God and their inheritance with Him. And we see that in Ephesians 1:13. Believers are unified by their common hope and destiny. We are all promised eternal life with God, for which we will be perfected and made like Jesus. You can check out 1 John 3:2 for that. Looking at verse 5 now, believers are unified in that we all answer to the same authority, Jesus Christ, God Himself. Now, we are hopefully each serving locally and submitting to local church leadership. But at the end of the day, Jesus, not a priest, pastor, or elder board, is the one that we answer to. Believers are also unified in their trust of Jesus. We may differ on a lot of particulars, but genuine believers are all counting on Jesus, not themselves, anyone, or anything else, to rescue them from sin and death. We also share a common baptism. Now, this may raise some eyebrows at first. Some of us were dunked, and others were sprinkled. Some were believers, and some were infants. And there is truth to be discovered on the biblical intent regarding time and method of baptism. But the vital and common core of baptism still unites us as an outward representation or symbol of what Christ has done for us. By going through baptism, we symbolize and display the fact that we have been cleansed of our sin by the work of Jesus. It's not that act that it doesn't do that, that it doesn't cleanse us itself of our sin, but it is it's a symbol that unites us and puts on display what has been done for us. Verse 6, as believers, despite our differing views about Him, we all have the same God, who has adopted us all as His children. We all have the same God ruling over us, the same God working through us, and the same God living inside of us. So what's in all this for geeks? Sometimes we have been hurt by people enough, or fear being hurt or judged so much, that we actually want to stay separated from individuals or people groups. We assume they can't understand us enough to be a good friend. We take on an inner attitude of kind of critical judgment toward others, which justifies our desire for separation from someone. You know, in our minds, it justifies it. Or even justifies in our minds our isolation from many people. We focus on our differences and kind of resolve that we can't have unity with so-and-so until they change. You know, sure, we tell ourselves we have unity with them, but we don't want to hang out with them. What is that? We quote unquote love them, we just don't like them. But I think that these are just examples of us lowering the bar and attempting self-justification rather than being eager to have unity with other believers, as we saw is the intent for us when we were last in Ephesians. We'd be better off saying, Jesus, forgive me. I know I should have compassion, agape love, and a desire for unity with this person, but I just don't know how to get there. In fact, even if we never build unity with that so-and-so that we think that we can't have unity with, even if we never do build unity with so-and-so, we'd be better off and more humble confessing our sin in that for the rest of our lives than staying in this space where we kind of lie to ourselves in order to maintain comfort, in order to kind of justify, yeah, that's never going to work out. Oh, that's a hopeless cause or blah, 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 whatever. you know, so I'm justified in just kind of giving up on that, you know. I think we're much better off setting aside our attempts at self-justification and setting aside our attempts to lower the bar for ourselves. We're much better off saying, Jesus, forgive me. I don't know how to do this. I have no idea how to do this. I have no idea how that's possible. You know, because in that first scenario, the grace of Jesus is tireless in that. And we'd actually be surprised what he can do through us and in those kinds of situations. In that second scenario, where we just kind of lower the bar for ourselves and try to justify and say, you know what, this is a hopeless cause with this person. We're never going to be able to have any kind of real unity. You know, I'm justified in just kind of letting go of that. You know, in that second scenario, I think we actually cut ourselves off from growth and increasingly plug our ears to God. Over the last 10 years, I've discovered that there is a wider variety of geeks than I had first imagined. We have different backgrounds, different preferences, different temperaments, different maturities, different strengths, and different weaknesses. There are geeks I've learned from, geeks I've taught, geeks who have prayed for me, and geeks I've been concerned and been praying for. And there's this gross little part of my sarks, what the Bible calls the flesh, that wants to rank and categorize everyone in some way in comparison to myself. And while our differences are noteworthy at times, we have so much more important things in common if we will take a moment to reflect on them. I love that moment when I first realized that someone is a believer. I don't know if you can relate to this. You know, I'll see some sign on their car or a plaque in their house, if I'm in their house for the first time, that just makes their faith in Jesus obvious. It's like this split-second moment just before my prideful mind wonders about their political hang-ups or their doctrinal issues or whether or not they're really pursuing life with Christ. In that moment, before it becomes corrupted by my sin, we have the fundamental reality in common that we are both rescued by Jesus, despite the mess of our lives. It's not that hang-ups and issues aren't important, but they so quickly override my thoughts about others. It's so hard to hang on to the fundamental common story we both share, that common story that's so important to remember because it gives us common ground. It gives us the ability to have grace for others. It enables our ability to have unity. That common story that we're all adopted and we have the same dad. Feedback. Give me your thoughts on this podcast, Christian Geek Central, the YouTube channel, or anything else we're doing. What should we keep? What should we change? Or what's on your mind you'd like a potentially uninformed opinion on? We want to make this show and all of Christian Geek Central as fun and useful as we can, but I've got to hear from you guys to do that. You can send an email or audio file recorded on your phone to paeter@spiritblade.com. And I can't remember if I've ever said this, But hopefully this is understood. You know, if it's a question that is of like kind of like a personal nature, some struggle you're going through, I'm not going to share that on the podcast. You know, at the very least, I'll just leave your name out of it. You know, I want you guys, whatever is on your mind, to feel free to get in touch with me. All right. Well, if all has been going according to plan, then by the time you hear this, our move into our new house will be done. I'm sure we'll have boxes stacked everywhere as you hear this. I'm sure that my office will not be remotely functioning. Maybe just my computer plugged in and my microphone, and that's about it, just the bare minimum. But I won't have time to do much more before the next work week starts, because this weekend, as you listen to this, I should be driving off to my friend Mark in California. Some of you guys know that about twice a year, he and I get together. We're old buddies from high school, and we knew each other a little bit in junior high, but became buddies in high school. And we have these massive, like, board gaming weekends about twice a year, like these massive marathon board game weekends that I so enjoy. And so that's what should be going on this weekend. I'm going to leave my wife and boys alone in our new house with stacks of boxes around them. I love you. All right, that's it. I want to thank Katya from the Netherlands for that audiobook review, and Winston Crutchfield for all that stuff about the Doctor Who comics. Awesome stuff, guys. Thank you so much. And it was really great timing, too, with all the stuff that I've had going on, so I really appreciate that. Stay tuned, guys, for DS9 Shawarma after the credits, or jump back to episode 400 if you want to start from the beginning. Next week, if God allows it, and I, you know, have things together enough, I think I will. It'll probably just take some time to get the office really where I want it, but I think things should be functional enough to do reviews and the bare minimum of podcasting and stuff in a day or two. So next week, if God allows it, I will be reviewing either The Circle or Slight, and I'm not sure which one yet, but that's the plan. Till then, check out SpiritBlade.com and Christian Geek Central for more stuff made just for you guys. Thank you so much for making time for this show. Thank you so much for your prayers. Those of you who've been praying for me in the midst of our house hunting and the move and all this kind of stuff, thank you very much for that. I hope you guys have a great week, and that you'll join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground podcast as we continue to geek out and seek the truth.
The Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Painter Fremson with support from the Christian Geek Central community at ChristianGeekCentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit SpiritBlade.com. Thank you for listening.
Coming through the wormhole.
The Dominion has endured for 2,000 years and will continue to endure long after the Federation has crumbled into dust.
No!
5 years ago, no one had ever heard of Bajor or Deep Space Nine, and now all our hopes rest here.
We just watched the very unfittingly named Fascination. Oh, another Lawaxana Troi episode. There is a point in its favor. It's a farce. Another point in its favor. Star Trek sucks at comedy, if you've watched much Star Trek. And this is one of their bad comedy episodes.
This is attempting to be some sort of twisted rom-com. Think about that for a second.
This is Star Trek's PG version of a sex farce.
Yeah.
Oh.
Basically what it is there's phlebotinum on the station. What it is basically the ending twist.
Yeah, so we won't say what, but...
that is causing random people to be infatuated with other people on the station.
Let's be honest, not infatuated, just horny. Just make it... there's a horny beam going around.
Yeah,
let's not give it more dignity.
But it's not... For some reason, it's not just making the person... generally wanting to chase the opposite sex.
Yeah, it's always targeted on one special target.
Yeah, it's Jake Sisko goes after Major Kira, which is squicky on multiple
and that's,
levels.
And that's wacky fun. Because.
And then Kira's boyfriend, Baryle, is chasing Dax, and then Dax is chasing Sisko, and the dominoes just continue to fall in weirder and wronger directions.
And I just want to cut my arms more and more open.
Ugh.
It's just, it's trying to be funny, and it's not. And the only thing that's at all meaningful is Keiko has come back, and so we get to see Keiko and Molly, and O'Brien's dealing with the fact that his wife, if you remember, he sent her away so she could do some botany on Bajor, and it turns out her thing's going to be at least twice as long. And so they actually have a real marital issue, and they actually are arguing, and I guess they just work it out. And that's all fine and good, although it's kind of the Pat TV working it out kind of thing, but, geez, if that's the best you can do...
Well, and also, the way it's worked out is by Miles rolling over and agreeing to give her everything that she wants.
Well, and to be fair, she says, no, I don't want that full thing. So, I would say Keiko's not as bad as she's been in the past, because she's being unpleasant, but then O'Brien's being unpleasant. Well, these are both people who have spent so much time apart, they've forgotten how to get along together.
And they're both being a little unreasonable with each other, but it's an understandable kind of unreasonable.
Yeah.
You see,
and at least they
how
both
they
compromise
get to where they are, and they do.
Neither one just like gets his or her way all the time. Which is a nice change, because Keiko often is the one who just gets her way.
But Star Trek, you were talking about this during the episode, Star Trek tends to do this thing where if there's a relationship issue, 9 times out of 10, Star Trek will make the man wrong.
Yeah, because the woman is never wrong, never gets jealous, never speaks out of turn, or says the wrong thing, or anything like that. It's always... excuse me. It's always the man who's, like, the screw-up. It's just like a sitcom.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, Miles does do some things in this episode that are horrible, and that he did need to beg his wife's forgiveness for.
It's just, it often does the thing where it acts like the only one who did things wrong is Miles, or Riker, or whoever the guy in a relationship is. And, you know, that's again, not exclusive to Star Trek, but it's always irritating, especially when you keep trying to tackle real issues while you have this shallow view. And it just seems like they're not willing to let women be wrong very much. The few that they do are their more interesting characters. Kira, 7 of 9. But not much. You know, Star Trek is pretty good when it comes to racial things, I'd say. But when it comes to sexual things and gender, they have a lot of really bad, outdated views about, you know, women are there to look pretty and be idealized. But they don't seem to want to really get into females as characters for the most part. Again, with a few exceptions. Speaking of one of the terrible characters, again, back to Waxana Troi. She's one of these people who... I detest her because she not only is she demanding and brassy and bossy and selfish and bigoted, she's a powerful telepath who can read your mind, and she doesn't think anything of airing your dirty laundry in front of everyone else, whether it's actual or she'll make up her own just to make it funny. And it's the kind of things that, in most stories, this would be considered a villainous use of telepathy.
Yeah,
and with her, it's just wacky
your
fun.
Privacy. And I think I mentioned this the last time we had a Waxana episode, too, is I find it highly disturbing that here is a person with telepathic powers who seems to enjoy the discomfort of others.
Yeah.
That's scary.
It's bad enough if she's dismissing it, but you're right, she does seem to actually like it. Like, ha 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 ha, you fool. You need to answer to me. Like, she's bossing around one of Odo's people.
It's so funny that you're uncomfortable with me...
grabbing you.
Invading your personal space.
Or and just physically grabbing you and hugging you and doing what I want. It's like, again, it's a double standard. Because if you had a man doing that with a young woman...
Yeah, that's sexual assault. I'm sorry. It's not okay.
It's just messed up. Just imagine Picard doing that with Troi. Doing the same thing. An older man... grabbing someone and just like, oh, yeah, I know you really like me. La, la, la,
just
kind
of holding all over them and, you know.
Never letting them go. And they're clearly uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But because of their position, they dare not speak out. Again, it's like, it's not charming. And it'd be one of those things if you let her be a quote-unquote wrong in the show. But she's not. Every time she's an idiot.
The show acts like she's just whimsical and fun.
And it's just, that's what makes me mad about her. If she acted like that and the show called her on it, I'd be okay. It's Star Trek has a lot of those kind of characters. Neelix, where the show doesn't treat them like people want. Wesley Crusher, you know, where they act insufferably and everyone's just like, oh, that's
them. Everyone just takes it.
Yeah. But back to this episode, which there's not much to it.
Well, the one good thing in this episode, in my opinion, is the O'Brien's little daughter, Molly, who is freaking adorable.
As usual.
And I want to kidnap her. She is so cute.
Well,
and she has this adorable, freaky little alien stuffed animal. It's multicolored, and I don't know what it is, but I kind of want one.
Yeah, so in other words, an episode whose high point is a stuffed animal held by a toddler.
Yeah.
So, yeah, please, by all means, skip this episode. It may not be the worst, but it's not because this episode has good points. It's because the other episodes are even worse than this. Feel free to skip it, and probably skip the next two-part we're going to get, Past Tense, where we're going into the future of the past to learn a lesson that none of us really need to learn. We'll see you then.